I'm Ron Burke, and I'm the Lutheran campus pastor at Southwest Texas State University. And this particular random thought that I would like to share with you came out of some correspondence I had several years ago with a church in Hanley Falls, Minnesota, that some of you may know about. The name of the church is Yellow Medicine Lutheran Church. And I was so taken by this name that I wondered if there were more around like it. So I started doing some senseless research and came up with the following useless information. According to the Lutheran Church Directory of the United States, 1976 edition, there are real, live Lutheran congregations in the United States with the following names. And if you know some of these, you are particularly blessed. I hope none of you are from them or I will be embarrassed. But these are real names. Fertile Lutheran Church in Fertile, Iowa. Somber Lutheran Church, Northwood, Iowa. Soldier Lutheran Church, Soldier, Iowa. I am resisting making comments on most of these names. I hope you will recognize the virtue that I practiced in doing that. Hopeful Lutheran Church, Florence, Kentucky. I think that ties in with the theme here at Holden Village. Outer Drive Faith Lutheran Church, Detroit, Michigan. One of my favorites, Lear Lutheran Church, Metz, Michigan. Big Fork Lutheran Church, Big Fork, Minnesota. And one that is famous in many Lutheran circles, Climax Lutheran Church, Climax, Minnesota. I don't know how close that is to Wild Rice Lutheran Church. In Twin Valley, Minnesota. High Water Lutheran Church is in Westbrook, Minnesota. And Peerless Lutheran Church in Peerless, Montana. Another one of my favorites, the Lutheran Church of the Escarpment in Lewiston, New York. And the place where I never choose to be baptized, Cold Water Lutheran Church, Monroe, North Carolina. Bang Lutheran Church, Portland, North Dakota. Another one of my favorites, Dinky Memorial Lutheran Church, Asheville, Pennsylvania. Swamp Lutheran Church, Reinholds, Pennsylvania. Huff's Lutheran Church, Bartow, Pennsylvania. Old Goshenhoppen Lutheran Church in Waxhaw, Pennsylvania. Split Rock Lutheran Church in Brandon, South Dakota. Sinking Springs Lutheran Church, Midway, Tennessee. Luck Lutheran Church, not in Las Vegas, but in Luck, Wisconsin. Silent Lutheran Church, Madison, Wisconsin. And finally, St. Martini Lutheran Church in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. I was kind of struck as I went through looking at some of these names by the number of churches who in the Lutheran Church who are named after New Testament saints, such as St. Paul, St. John, St. Peter, you know all those. But I also noticed that there are a lot of deserving New Testament persons who have been completely ignored. Why aren't there churches with names like St. Martha's Lutheran Church? Or the Prodigal Son Lutheran Church? Or Ten Lepers Lutheran Church? What? Well, that's what I was... You're ahead of me. You read my column, Dory. Other appropriate names that I looked for but couldn't find were All Sinners Lutheran Church. Mortgaged Lutheran Church. And German Shepherd Lutheran Church. There are no Lutheran churches with those names. If any of you are in mission congregations and are searching for a name, I would offer these to you. No royalty whatsoever. Well, I think the group is gathered. We have made the transition time. The topic is private times for public persons. And if you were here for Elmer's Bible study, you know that I couldn't resist giving a little commercial about coming, and we were going to straighten out all the errors that Elmer made and answer all the questions that he raised. It gets kind of scary sometimes that I go places to do presentations with other people on the program, and very seldom, if ever, do we check or coordinate or anything like that. But I'm amazed that the number of times where they really dovetail, they really tie in. And this morning, I had to go back and do a little quick searching for some notes and things and switching some things in my head. But I think that what Elmer said this morning and what I have to say now really kind of tie in. He has been talking about over the last 3 days, Jesus as preacher, teacher, healer. And we was talking about healer this morning. And I have a presentation, which I'm not going to give to you, where I talk about three aspects of Jesus, but I include in there Jesus as healer, preacher, and prayer. Prayer. He is a person of prayer. And I base this on some passages just right after the ones we were looking at this morning in the first part of Mark. Specifically, that healing of Peter's mother-in-law, and all of the people of the community coming, the sick and those who had demons and gathering in front of the house, and he heals those. And then after that incident, there's this little passage. Very early the next morning, long before daylight, Jesus got up and left the house. He went out of town to a lonely place where he prayed. And it seems to me as if those two are tied in. Jesus was a healer. We talked about that this morning. It's rather obvious that he was a healer. But he was also a prayer, a man of prayer. He was a very public person, as is seen in this whole passage, with the whole town gathered, attracted there because of his reputation as a healer. And these people were crying out for healing, not just for their demons, but also for their physical ailments. And a healer comes into town, a miracle worker. That word spreads rapidly, and those people came looking for him. And he met with those people. He was a very public person. We have accounts of that just throughout the gospel, where he deals with the multitudes. Jesus ministered to the multitudes, but he also went away to the lonely places to pray. And there are just any number of occasions in the Gospels like this where we have Jesus being very actively involved in a very public kind of ministry, followed by him going off to a lonely place to pray or up in the mountains by himself, these kinds of things. It was obvious to me that in these private times of prayer that Jesus got the power to perform his public acts of healing and preaching. As William Barclay says, Jesus knew that if he was to meet people, he must first meet God. And it was in these private times, these silent places, these places of solitude, that Jesus met God and got his power. And I think that truth holds true for us today. There is no question but that we of the 20th century are looking for a healer. You know, if we hear a healer comes to town, we flock to get the results and the power and the healing that is offered. If Jesus were to come and heal people, we would be first in line. The world is full of people today with tortured bodies and tormented souls, people suffering the pain of physical illness and disease, the anguish of mental and emotional turmoil and distress. Now, I'm not sure that really came out this morning, but it's my understanding that really when the Bible talks about people having evil spirits and demon-possessed, that was kind of their same way of referring to people that we would call emotionally ill or mentally retarded, that kind of thing today. You can argue that emotional disease, mental disease, is demon possession, or you can do it vice versa. I'm not getting into that. But what I'm saying is that healing is not just a physical thing. It is also an emotional, a mental, a spiritual aspect too. And the thing about this that I think concerns me is that even though as private people, we may be concerned about our aches and pains mentally and physically, those also affect us as public people. There's a little passage in one of my favorite books, a very popular book that you undoubtedly are aware of, John Powell's little book, Why Am I Afraid to Love? where he gets into this. And let me quote that. Powell says that once I asked a psychiatrist friend of mine, how can you teach people to love? And his answer was mildly surprising, to say the least. He answered the question by asking one of his own, did you ever have a toothache? Of whom were you thinking during the distress of your toothache? His point was clear. When we are in pain, even if it be only the passing discomforts of an aching tooth, we are thinking about ourselves. The psychiatrist continued, this is a pain-filled world in which we are living, and the pains that reside deep in the human hearts around us are not like toothaches. We go to bed with them at night, and we wake up with them in the morning. 2/3 of all the hospital beds in this country are now occupied by mental patients. 1 out of 10 Americans has already been treated for mental illness. The pain inside of them simply became too deep and required professional attention. The suicide rates in the 18 to 21-year age group is extremely high. Suicide ranks as the 3rd highest killer in this age group. In the 21 to 24-year age group, it is the 4th highest killer. This is a pain-filled world, and so a loveless world that we live in. Most human beings are so turned in by their own pains that they cannot get enough out of themselves to love other people to any great extent, unquote. And in this account of Jesus of healing Simon's mother-in-law, it's rather interesting that that scene ends with the sentence, she'd been sick and Jesus heals her. The fever left her and she began to wait on them. No sooner was she healed than she began to attend to the needs of those around her. She used her recovered health for renewed service. And if we are to serve others, love others, if we are to be public people, we need to be freed from the pain that centers all of our attention on ourselves. Healing brings not only freedom from pain, but also freedom to love. We all need healing. But how do we get healed? Well, this is where I get around to my subject. And I think that for me, there are many ways, but I think one very specific way is this aspect of Jesus as a prayer and the example that he set there of going off into a lonely place to pray. I think that one source of healing for us today is through prayer. A lot of people here are telling their stories. Maybe this is a time for me to tell a little bit of my story. On Monday, I referred to the fact that my interest in this whole contemplative lifestyle and prayer and silence and solitude came out of some crisis times. And some of you, being the curious people that you are, wanted to know what were your crisis times. And shared a little bit of that with some of you individually and have found out that many of you, if not all of you here, all of us here, have had crisis times in our life. And many times those have forced us to God. And that's an interesting aspect of crisis times for me, is that many times they, in the long run, as I look back at them, they've been very good. And I'm not too quick anymore to say what's bad and good when it happens to me at the particular time. I have to wait a while and get perspective. But the event or events that really led me to being where I am today started back around 1970 when I was campus pastor at Texas A&M University. And one day in my office started getting very faint and didn't quite pass out, but almost. They rushed me to the doctor, and the doctor, typical GP, pardon me, doctors in the crowd, but was rushed and kind of got me back on my feet. And they did some tests and things and couldn't find anything physically wrong, or he couldn't. He said, oh, it's all in your head. You're working too hard. Go home. Here's some tranquilizers. Well, I lived off of tranquilizers for about the next month, and that changed a little bit my attitude towards drugs, because I probably could not have survived if I had not had those. So there's a good side of drugs, too. But finally, it got so bad that I was just convinced that it was not all in my mind, that it had to be something physical. And I finally went to a specialist, and after about 5 minutes of conversation with him, he says, I think you have a good case of hypoglycemia. Let's run some glucose tolerance tests. So he did, and sure enough, that's what I had. Hypoglycemia is low blood sugar. It's a very in disease of this generation. Lots of people have it. Well, I've had it, folks. I just want you to know that. Anyway, through diet and various other things, was able to deal with it. And I can stand before you today, some 12 years later, and say that I am, quote, healed. I have not really had any problems at all with it in the last 5 or 6 years. Now, how did I come to this place today? Well, I won't tell you the whole story, but a couple of things I guess should be said. First of all, it was not a miraculous overnight cure. This demon did not come out of me that one day, and I was healed after that. No, it took at least 6 or 7 years for me to recover from the ravages of that dark time. It was undoubtedly the deepest, darkest time in my whole life, and I don't ever care to go through that again, folks. And secondly, I guess I realized that my hypoglycemia, my physical ailment, was just a symptom of a much deeper problem. And my basic problem was mental and emotional. I could not stand up to the stress and the tension and the pressure of my life. And once I had the true diagnosis of my problem, then I went seeking a cure. And I think the primary reason why I can stand in front of, or sit in front of you today, and say that I am, quote, healed, is because of prayer, specifically discovering this whole thing called contemplative prayer, private and solitary prayer. As a minister, I am a very public person. I can really identify with Jesus when the disciples come looking for him in his lonely place saying, "Everybody's looking for you." Well, that's a minister's life in a nutshell there, you know. No matter how hard you try to get away, there's always somebody who finds you. That's one thing I like about Holden Village. It takes a while. I'm not too sure I like that idea of carrier pigeons coming in here or not. It's very hard, anyway, in the pastoral profession to get away, hard to find a time and a place to be alone. And that was especially true for me in College Station, Texas, some 12 years ago. I was just flat drained. All of the life and energy was being sucked out of my body and my soul. And I needed somehow to get my batteries recharged, somehow to plug into the source of power and replace that which was flowing out of me. I was giving and not receiving. And anyone who knows anything at all about supply and demand knows that you can only give as you've got. You can't share something you don't have. And fortunately, I realized that Jesus was a good example to follow. He gave much more than I ever did, but he never seemed to run dry. And why and where and how did he receive all of his power and his energy? And that is when I began to see that the importance of these times of silence and solitude in the life of Jesus. And so I began to do some investigating. And lo and behold, I found that there was a very vast aspect of my spiritual heritage that I just really hadn't heard about, even in seminary. And that was this whole thing called contemplation, the use or the approach of prayer, one's prayer life and spiritual life, on a silent, solitary kind of level. More being than doing. And I started doing some research and reading and talking to people and going to conferences and places. And suddenly my life was really changed. And I guess that's not only why I'm healed today, but why I have sort of become a, quote, missionary for this kind of thing, to spread this word to people that who are looking in this pressure pot world in which we live for some sort of healing, for some sort of help. That we have that right in our spiritual heritage. And it's an excellent way to deal with all of these stresses and pressures that come upon all of us. Today I would like to go, that's kind of the general introduction to that, into some specifics of how to do this kind of thing. The two key words are silence and solitude. Monday I talked a lot about silence. If you weren't here, there is a tape available. I've just found out I get no royalties on my tape. But I'll push them anyway. So we talked a lot about silence and a little bit about solitude. And I think those are the two keys. Where to start? I guess we're saying on a very practical level that you need to, first of all, find a place, pardon me, that you can be alone and that you can be silent. And that's not that easy to find in our world today. But each person can look for those places. Now, you come to a place like Holden Village, there's a lot of obvious places around. You know, what more ideal place in the world to be in a place that evokes spiritual thoughts? But most of us are not going to stay here. We're going to go home to ringing telephones and crying kids and jobs and so forth and so on. How do we find a place there? Well, I can't really tell you, but I bet there is a place there. Most of us have kind of our place. It may just be our chair. For me, that's what it is. You know, there used to be this thing called the family altar or the home altar where people actually built little altars and put them up. I don't see many of those anymore. But I have one in my house. It's an old beat-up recliner that I hope is still there when I get home. My wife is an interior designer or at work while I'm gone, and she hinted that that would sure look good at our ranch. I'm probably going to be a goat sitting in my reclining chair. Anyway, that is my daily place. I get up and I do my normal things, and I get my cup of tea, and I go down and I get in my recliner, and there I do my contemplation for the day, which is usually a little reading, Bible reading, spiritual reading, and journaling. We talked about that the other day, reflecting my thoughts on paper, and prayer. Sometimes very obvious traditional kind of prayer where I specifically think of people or issues or causes or things that I am concerned about and I want to bring to God in prayer. A lot of times, though, I just sit there and listen. But that place has become my place of prayer. And I read somewhere some psychologists had done some research with students about study places. And they had found out that there is this environmental psychology that some of you may be familiar with, how certain places affect our minds and all that, that if a student has one place that is their study place, that they come in and they sit down at that place, just almost automatically their bodies and minds and everything are conditioned, this is time to study. And it makes that transition period much easier to do. I'm finding that very true in my prayer place. I sit down there and I'm ready to do that kind of thing. I use one specific place for that. And I have found that to be a good practical advice for people. Find your one place for that. Now, naturally, it should be a, as I say, a quiet place. And that will vary greatly from person to person. The other key thing is time. If you can have a regular time, like mine, I'm an empty nester, our kids are gone now. Oh, homes are quiet after kids leave. And my wife works, she leaves about 7:30, campus ministry. We work on the other end of the day, so I don't usually go into the office about 10 o'clock. Students are either not awake or they're in class, So I have the freedom of that. So I have that time built right into my day. It's a very natural time. And I'm very jealous about that time. That's my time with God. And I get a little upset if I have to change that. And I think that's something that if you find a time, wherever it is, respect that time. Put it on your calendar. You know, those of us who keep calendars, we put all our other appointments on our calendar. Put an appointment with God on your calendar. Pastors It's kind of hard for them to do it, but I know some of them who tell their secretaries, you know, this time from 10 to 11, that's my contemplation time. I will take no calls. I will not be disturbed. That's kind of hard, you know. Parishioners call up and say, can I talk to the pastor? No. Why not? Well, if you say he's in a meeting, oh, okay. Or he's counseling somebody, oh, that's okay. But you say he's sitting in his office being quiet. But I've found that most people will respect that. And if you're a little shy about that, you can just say, I'm sorry, I have another commitment at that time. If people want to interfere with that. And most people don't ask what your other commitment is. That's a great coverall. I just use that for everything now. If I don't want to do anything, I'm sorry, I have another commitment. Yes, ma'am.
Do you have a time alone?
My wife is my only family right now, other than a cat. My cat has really fouled up my journal keeping. Gets in my lap. Yes, my wife respects that, and she has her time, and I respect that. Now, with children, that's tough. And I don't have any real practical advice for those of you who have children. But if something like this is meaningful enough to you, you'll find the time. It's like everything. If we really want to do it, you'll find the time. You may have to get up a little earlier or stay up a little later or something of that nature. It is harder. There's no question about it. But I found even that, not with me, but with some people I know that try to do this, that their children can be very understanding about this. If you'll be very frank and honest with them. Say, this is my quiet time. And I will give you time afterwards if that you have that problem. The real bugaboo is the telephone. Take that rascal off the hook. Nothing bugs me more than the fact that I have been conditioned to be a slave to that little black box. No matter what I'm doing, it rings, you know, and you're in the shower. Or you go traipsing all over the thing, it's wrong number or something. Most of us really cannot ignore a ringing telephone. Try that sometimes. If it's really an emergency, people, they'll get hold of you sometime. Most of them aren't. But in this kind of thing, loud noise can be very disturbing, and my suggestion is just take it off the hook or unplug it if you have it in a jack or something like that. Or if you got a recorder, the answering kind of thing, which is becoming more and more common, put that on. Tell people, don't call me now, I'm busy. Yes, Dorothy.
Then I suggest putting the timer on so that you remember to put the telephone back. That's my problem. I'll take the telephone off the hook and then realize it's been off the hook all day.
Oh, that's too bad, isn't it? Yeah, well, if they're true friends, they'll understand. Well, those are a couple of practical things that I wanted to suggest about on a daily basis. The other thing that is very important in my life is I mentioned the fact that I'm here today and in other places that I am not only a pastor, I'm also a rancher. I'm a pastor in the true sense of the word. That's a Greek word for shepherd. I inherited a ranch in Texas where we run goats instead of sheep. I may share a little thought on that one of these mornings. But that is a very important place for me. And I think I inherited that about 3 years ago, and I have probably been at my peak professionally and personally and pastorally the last 3 years. And I very selfishly believe it's because of that ranch. It is my escape place, my getaway place, my retreat. And I don't go there every day. It's 125 miles away. In Texas, that's not very far, but it's still not a place you just run up there to see what's happening. But in my life as a pastor, it's all head work, emotional work. I get very involved with people and words. And I'm not one of those who likes to jog or do exercises. I'm an old jock and all that stuff, and I don't mind doing exercises for some purpose, to win a game or something, but just to run around in circles, that's... So I need the discipline of physical activity, and the ranch is that. And I go off there and get involved in, you know, all working with goats or building fence or cleaning out dirty tanks, all these kinds of things. That is very therapeutic for me, very healing for me. It's an excellent balance. I don't know whether you have a place like that. I find that most people do, of one form or another. Use that. Use that place. If you don't have one, find a place. If it's just going off to the beach, or going sailing, or going fishing, or going hunting, or whatever, do it. Those extended times away, I think, are very important for the balance in our life. And that's really what it is. The balance between being a private and a public person. You go too far one way, you're a hermit. You go too far the other way, you're a basket case. You know, you live at the beck and call of everybody else. And I found now in my own life that I can only really be a public person as I am a private person. I get all of my source of energy out of those private times to be a public person. One other thing I want to do with you this morning is to share something that has been very meaningful for me and with a lot of people that I've shared it. And this is a little exercise on how does one get into the mood of contemplation and meditation when you find that quiet place, that place of solitude. So if you will, I would ask you to participate. If you don't want to participate, at least be quiet. What we're going to do here is just expose you to, as I say, some very basic things. Some of you may have done this before. To some, it may be completely new. Even if it's old hat with you, it's the kind of thing that most people enjoy doing. You cannot deal with the soul, with the mind, without being concerned about the body. We're all together. You know, you can't really separate them. And you have to respect the body because it can really either compete with your contemplation or complement your contemplation. So the position and the condition of the body is very important. So what I'd like for you to do, if you are willing, first of all, there is a traditional kind of posture, and that is to get in your chair with your feet flat on the floor. Well, grow. You might also like to take things out of your lap. I think you can put them on the floor. This is a fairly trustworthy group. And your back firmly against the chair so that your back is erect.
My legs don't reach you.
Put them on the rungs. Where are you? The reason for this position is twofold. One, most of us don't sit this way, but it is amazing how long you can sit in a position like this. It really is kind of comfortable. The other thing is that it keeps your spine straight and keeps your diaphragm uncluttered. And breathing is very, very important, not only for life, but also for spiritual life. I would like for you... Oh, the other thing is, if you put with these arms, I'm not sure, but kind of your hands relaxed and open. This is a traditional form of prayer, a gesture of prayer. You may, hands open to receive whatever God has to offer. Now I'd like for you just to breathe. Kind of concentrate on your breathing for a minute. Now take one of your hands and place it on your tummy and inhale and exhale. Now when you inhale, did your hand go out or in? How many of your hands went out? How many of your hands went in? Okay, Your hands should go out if you are doing proper diaphragmatic breathing. Those of you who are musicians and singers and speakers, your diaphragm, think of it just as a big bottle or a balloon, if you want to do it that way. And when you breathe, take in air, you're just filling up that balloon, and it's expanding. But it's surprising how many of us do not do that. you ask somebody to take a deep breath and they, chest out and all that. Well, that's just the opposite. Tummy out, which is not socially acceptable in our day and age, but that's okay. So concentrate on that just for a moment, inhaling so that you are expanding your diaphragm. And when you exhale, you're just squeezing your diaphragm and forcing that out. Try that just a moment. Now, supposedly there is a scientific chemical reaction taking place here with the oxygen and all that, which I do not understand. But if you're doing this properly, it's kind of like a tranquilizing effect chemically on your body, and it can be very relaxing. Next is to kind of try to get this in a rhythm, so let's try to do that. Let's see if we can all do this together. Inhale. One, two, three, four. Exhale. Two, three, four. Inhale. If I don't say exhale, please do that. Okay, the next thing, you may put your hand off of your tummy now, unless you like it there, that's fine. The next thing is kind of closing out distractions, and the best way to do that is simply to shut your eyes. For those of you who do have contacts and don't like to do that, the other alternative is just to stare at something. Find the back of your neighbor's head or a point on the wall or something up here. Either close your eyes or stare at something. Again, we're a trustworthy group. I will not do anything to you. Now, just like you are, I would like to sort of take you through a little relaxation exercise, again, which some of you may be familiar with and some of you may not. Take you through your body and ask you to concentrate on relaxing the various parts of your body. Let's start by relaxing your toes. Concentrate on relaxing your toes. In this relaxed condition, I would like to share with you a very familiar Bible passage. On the evening of that same day, Jesus said to his disciples, "Let us go across to the other side of the lake." So they left the crowd. The disciples got into the boat in which Jesus was already sitting, and they took him with them. Other boats were there too. And suddenly a strong wind blew up, and the waves began to spill over into the boat so that it was about to fill with water. Jesus was in the back of the boat, sleeping with his head on a pillow. The disciples woke him up and said, "Teacher, don't you care that we are about to die?" Jesus stood up and commanded the wind, "Be quiet." And he said to the waves, "Be still." The wind died down, and there was a great calm. And then Jesus said to his disciples, "Why are you frightened? Do you still have no faith?" I would like you now, through the wondrous power of imagination in your minds, to put yourself into that scene that we've just heard. Picture yourself by the side of a lake. You're there on the shore of that lake with Jesus and his disciples. Picture those in your mind. Now see yourself in your mind get on a sailboat with Jesus and the disciples and push out onto that lake. As you float across that lake, what are the things you see? Look around and see the sights, the scene that you see. What are the sounds that you hear on that boat in that lake? What are the things you feel? The wind, the water, the sun. What are the things you feel? What can you taste? The water, the perspiration. What are the things that you can taste?